ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 1st of April. I'm Rachel Mealy, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people. Today, it's official. Property prices have hit record highs across Australia and it's set to stay that way for some time. And Ozempic. Global supply shortages have seen copies of the drug hit the market. We look at whether better regulation is needed and access improved for all Australians.
Better access at a reasonable price would mean better health for Australians. Now, there's very good evidence that Ozempic are very good for people who have type 2 diabetes, as well as people who have obesity but don't have diabetes.
But first, protesters have taken to the streets of Israel calling for an end to the prime ministership of Benjamin Netanyahu. The protesters are calling for an immediate ceasefire as well as a deal to free the Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on the 7th of October. But as Palestinians celebrate Ramadan and Easter, the Israeli offensive shows no signs of letting up. Alison Shaw reports.
In Gaza City, dozens of Palestinian Christians gathered to mark Easter Sunday. Winnie Tarazi is one of them.
We aren't happy this Easter. This doesn't feel like Easter because we are here deprived of our homes, our belongings, our children and everything. We've lost our family. These are abnormal days.
For Palestinians seeking refuge in southern Gaza, finding clean water is becoming harder and harder. This mother is living in a makeshift camp in Mwasi.
The ambulance took all my children at night. They were suffering from colic and vomiting. This is because of the water, of course. The water is polluted. We are forced to drink salt water, well water. This is not clean at all.
UNICEF's James Elder says disease and malnutrition is threatening lives across large parts of Gaza.
You can't devastate a sanitation system and a water system to this level and not have disease outbreaks. Families have done everything they can to protect their children from bombardment. Now I see mothers crying over severely malnourished children.
Last week, the UN Security Council passed a bill calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and the release of all hostages. It's a call that's been echoed by Pope Francis this weekend in his Easter address. UNICEF's James Elder says a ceasefire is the only way to get adequate aid into Gaza.
As this goes on and as decisions continue not to be made for a ceasefire, you're seeing lives lost, you're seeing homes lost and dignities being denied. So yes, at a time of Ramadan, anything is critical to people, but what they would really see as a gift would be a ceasefire.
In Israel, thousands of Israelis have taken to the streets of Tel Aviv in one of the largest anti-government demonstrations since the start of the Gaza conflict.
We came to call on them, on this government to resign. This is a government that has failed us repeatedly.
The protesters also want a ceasefire deal so the dozens of Israeli hostages captured on October 7 can be released. They're calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to step down and hold elections. In a national televised address before his surgery for a hernia, Mr. Netanyahu insisted he's doing everything in his power to free the hostages.
The calls for election now in the middle of the war, just before the victory, will paralyse Israel for at least 6 months, 8 months in my estimation.
The Prime Minister's decision to call off an Israeli delegation that was set to visit Washington also marks a low point for relations between the United States and Israel. Mr. Netanyahu moved to later reschedule the meeting, but Richard Haass, former director of policy planning at the US State Department, told CNN this is a watershed moment.
The United States may have to think about limits on economic aid of sorts or military aid. It's an uncomfortable place to be, but I would argue that is where Israeli policy has brought us.
It comes after the United States abstained from a UN Security Council resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In past votes, it had used its veto power to block such resolutions.
Alison Shaw. A group of visiting Ukrainian security experts is urging Australia to step up assistance and cooperation to help defeat Russia's invasion, warning local officials that China is closely watching events in Europe. To date, Australia's donated around $960 million to the war effort, but the government's refusal to reopen an embassy in the capital, Kyiv, continues to cause frustration. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
At Germany's Ramstein Air Base in the country's southwest, Australian defence personnel are preparing to end a six-month deployment. They've been operating an E-7A wedge-tail surveillance aircraft in support of Ukraine's war against Russia, but the contribution is winding down. In this defence video, Chief of Joint Operations Lieutenant General Greg Bilton says around 60 Australians are currently supporting the aerial mission,
which enables the platform to run on a pretty active schedule over a six-month period. So that deployment will come to an end in April.
In the United Kingdom, Australian soldiers continue their Operation Kudu mission to train recruits for the front line. But back in Canberra, visiting Ukrainian security experts are arguing the federal government could contribute more. Dr. Hanna Shalest is the Security Studies Program Director for the Ukrainian PRISM Foreign Policy Council.
It took us additional efforts to explain that you would have problems in Asia Pacific if you would not help us. China is definitely watching how Russia would be punished, or would it be punished, and then would decide their actions in not only in Taiwan, in Philippines and in other places.
The visiting expert says Australia's military and humanitarian contributions so far have been greatly appreciated, but the government's steadfast refusal to reopen its embassy in Kyiv is puzzling.
Most of the embassies reopen. So it seems to me that it is more of the political decision rather than security-wise.
Dr. Shalest warns Australia is missing out on vital information by not having its diplomats inside the war-torn country.
It means that you can organise the work of your embassy in the proper way. And that will definitely help, first of all, politically, because Australia will have the first-hand information about what is needed, because the real briefings you can have only inside of the countries. You would not be able to have it while sitting somewhere abroad.
Independent Victorian Senator David Vann is a vocal supporter of Ukraine and says DFAT Secretary Jan Adams must change her position on having Australia's embassy operate out of neighbouring Poland.
The Department Secretary is adamant that it's a work health and safety issue, yet she's maintained an embassy in Israel for the whole time, even though there's missiles and rockets flying there each and every day. So if anything needs to be done, we spend millions of dollars on our posts overseas in other challenging countries. Why wouldn't we just do the same there in Kyiv?
The federal government insists the embassy decision is based on security advice, and to date, its financial contribution in support of Ukraine has totaled almost $1 billion. But recently, German researchers have estimated Australia has slipped to 31st spot among donor countries when the size of each nation's economy is taken into account.
Andrew Green. Despite rising interest rates and a cost of living crisis, Australian property prices have reached a fresh record high. According to new data, Sydney's median property value is now $1.07 million, up 8% on a year ago, while Perth, Adelaide and Brisbane have all seen double-digit growth in property prices. With demand outstripping supply, analysts expect prices to keep climbing. But there is one significant risk facing the national housing market. Here's our business reporter, David Taylor.
Whether you're selling or buying, property market analysts say it's been a busy start to 2024.
We've seen that new listings volumes have really surged, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, giving buyers a lot more choice. But home buying demand has really been able to absorb that uplift in listings hitting the market so far.
That's Eleanor Cray, senior economist at PropTrack, which is a division of real estate firm REA Group. It's released its latest home price index, which tracks property prices across the country.
National home prices lifted 0.34% in March to hit a new record high. Now that brings prices up just under 7% above their March 2023 levels.
Now, is this the average national home price or the median national home price?
So that's the National Home Price Index. So the PropTrack Home Price Index shows that national home prices rose 0.34%. to hit a fresh record high.
Home prices grew for both the combined capital cities and regional areas. Perth achieved record price gains in the first 3 months of the year and rose 18.6% from the year prior.
It is the strongest pace of growth that Perth has recorded in well over a decade, or at least a decade.
And why?
So Perth has really seen this streak of relative outperformance. And don't forget, this follows a streak of relative underperformance. So that's probably one of the factors as to why we're seeing Perth really record such strong growth. Affordability constraints aren't quite as challenging as they are in Perth. In Perth as they are in other capital city markets. And at the same time, we've pretty much got close to record low supply of properties available for sale.
Adelaide and Brisbane also reached a fresh peak in home prices last month, with prices growing by 13.5% and 13% respectively over the year to March. AMP's chief economist, Shane Oliver, says demand for housing in Australia is outstripping supply, putting upwards pressure on prices.
It's basically a supply shortage story. And of course, the most affordable cities in Australia, which are also often the cities which are seeing the strongest interstate migration, they're the ones that are strongest, such as particularly Perth and also Brisbane.
And the shortage of housing, says Shane Oliver, is set to persist. However, what could put a lid on growth in prices or even lead to lower prices is interest rates staying higher for longer.
But if those rate cuts are delayed, then it's quite conceivable that we'll see more Australian homeowners struggle with their mortgages, have to put their properties on the market. We see a pickup in distressed listings, and then you could see prices start to fall back again, despite that that undersupply of housing. So I think that
lower growth or prices actually coming down?
Well, our base case is we'll just see simply lower growth or modest growth in property prices going forward. But the risk is that if, say, rate cuts are delayed into next year and we see much higher unemployment, in other words, the Reserve Bank leaves the high rates in place for too long, then we could start to see property prices fall in that scenario. But I think the more likely scenario is that we will get rate cuts sometime in the next 6 months, and that will start to provide some support to the property market. But in the interim, we probably end up with ongoing modest growth in property prices, neither a boom nor a bust, but obviously a lot depends on what interest rates do.
AMP's chief economist, Shane Oliver, ending that report by David Taylor. On ABC Radio across Australia, this is The World Today. Thanks for your company. The advent of a class of drugs known as semaglutides has been a breakthrough in medical science. The injectable drug Ozempic is only approved and subsidised in Australia for treating diabetes, but doctors can prescribe it for weight loss at their discretion, and there's been an explosion in the use of the drug. But an ABC Four Corners investigation has found that copied versions of the drugs are being illegally exported from Australia under the noses of drug regulators. Doctors in Australia say sorting out the global supply of the drugs will help stamp out so-called cowboy producers. John Wentworth is an adult endocrinologist at the Royal Melbourne Hospital and diabetes researcher at the Walter and Eliza Hall Institute. John Wentworth, what's your view about access to Ozempic in Australia?
Well, we don't have enough supply, and that's a big problem for our patients. I have become increasingly concerned about the compounding pharmacy supply of Ozempic, because that's clearly a different product, and we don't understand how it works, or if it works as well as the branded version. And we obviously don't understand if it's safe or not, because it's never been trialled rigorously in a large number of people.
Could compounding pharmacies be relieving the global supply shortage if they were better regulated?
Well, yes, but they couldn't. I imagine they couldn't run a business, because the only way they could provide compounded Ozempic, in my view, would be to buy it from the parent company, Novo Nordisk, which is not going to sell it to them because it wants to maintain a stranglehold on the market.
What impact do you see more access to drugs like Ozempic having on the wider health system in Australia?
Better access at a reasonable price would mean better health for Australians. Now, there's very good evidence that Ozempic and a drug like it that's also approved called Mounjaro are very good for people who have type 2 diabetes, as well as people who have obesity but don't have diabetes. There's now very strong evidence that these drugs improve glucose, they help people lose weight, and they protect them from the major complications of diabetes, notably heart attacks and strokes and other problems with the cardiovascular system. Now, we routinely treat people with other medications for these purposes, most notably blood pressure and cholesterol medications. And when the price is right and the supply is right, increasingly we'll be offering drugs like Ozempic to the same people to help them live longer, better, healthier lives. From a medical perspective is what we're trying to do day in, day out. And that's why we are looking forward to the day where there is enough supply at a reasonable price for us to be able to optimise the health of the nation.
So putting the supply issues to the side, you say that a wider availability of Ozempic would help Australians in their health issues.
Yes, I think yes. And the key question will be at what cost? And that's a massive problem for any health innovation or intervention. And that again is that's a very difficult thing to decide. It's a very difficult thing to get an answer to. But I think if we did have supply of Ozempic at an affordable price for individuals or for the health system, then of course we would offer it to people because there are so many benefits, and we understand what the downsides and the side effects are, and we can manage them as long as we know what we're dealing with.
That's endocrinologist Associate Professor John Wentworth from the Royal Melbourne Hospital. An artificial intelligence company says its new program that can recreate anyone's voice after hearing them speak for just 15 seconds is too risky for public release. AI ethics experts say the technology is already being misused and it could have consequences when the United States and the United Kingdom go to the polls later this year, as Angus Randall reports.
This is the voice of a real human.
Imagine you're riding a bike down a hill. First, the push you give off the ground is the force that gets you going.
And this is a voice created entirely using artificial intelligence.
A rainforest is a place with a lot of precipitation, and it has many kinds of animals, trees, and other plants.
The US tech company OpenAI says it can take just 15 seconds of your voice and create a virtual version of you. It's a long way from the early text-to-speech generators that came with your PC in the late 90s.
Hello, I am Microsoft Sam. I am obsolete.
Professor Toby Walsh is the chief scientist at the University of New South Wales AI Institute. He says this new program has been trained on thousands of hours of audio to create a realistic imitation.
It used to require hours and hours of someone's audio. They had to say special phrases so you could learn them. But because it's been trained on such a volume of speech in general, it knows about the way that people do change and modulate their voices. And then it just has to learn exactly how your voice is.
There are some handy uses. It'll be much cheaper and easier to create audiobooks and dub foreign language films. And OpenAI says the technology could change the lives of people who lose their voice. But the company says it's still deciding how to roll out its voice engine technology safely to the public, and it acknowledges there are serious risks of misuse in a US election year. Its current policy says the tech can only be used to recreate someone's voice with their consent, and listeners must be made aware they're hearing an AI-generated voice. Rebecca Johnson is an AI ethicist at the University of Sydney.
These technologies are really fantastic and have a lot of potential for doing good things in the world. But their potential for risk is less in the realm of science fiction and Terminator and more in the realm of real things such as, you know, election interference, safety and security and of people. So I'm glad that this big conversation that, you know, many people in the world have been having and the media has been promoting over the last 18 months has actually had some impact back on these companies to start to really think about their accountability and their responsibilities in our society.
There have already been examples of using AI voices to try and disrupt the US election. In New Hampshire earlier this year, thousands of voters received a call from a fake Joe Biden telling them not to vote in the state's Democratic primary.
Your vote for the November election.
Rebecca Johnson says this year could be pivotal in how we control AI technology.
We're facing the biggest election year in the history of the world this year. You know, half of the world is actually going to go to the polls this year with elections in over 60 countries. And this happens to coincide with, you know, the development of technologies, generative technologies for both images and for sound and for voice that could be really badly used by bad actors to interfere with a lot of these elections.
In the meantime, Toby Walsh says you can't trust anything you hear.
It's very easy to fake the phone number. It's very easy to fake the voice. Actually, I tell people now you should have a secret question in your family. If someone rings you up, you ask them, what is the answer to your secret question, whatever it is? And equally, if someone, some business rings you up, a banker rings you up, you've always got to ring them back. The only way you can be sure who has rung you is if you ring them.
Professor Toby Walsh from UNSW talking to our very human Angus Randall. There's a national shortage of Auslan interpreters, and regional and rural Australians are feeling it the most. In Rockhampton, there's only one certified professional interpreter, and when she's sick or unavailable, the deaf community is left relying on friends and family or virtual video services, which can be unreliable given poor internet access. Jasmine Hines reports.
Kelly Green was born and raised in Rockhampton, but when it came time for university, she decided to leave central Queensland.
It was very hard for me to advocate for myself, and they didn't quite understand what access for a deaf person looks like and what we need. So I decided to move to Brisbane for better access.
Kelly's speaking to us via an Auslan interpreter. She says she returned to her hometown to live last year after more than two decades.
So surprised at how behind Rockhampton still is. It's not enough understanding of what our needs are as a deaf community. So I'm hoping to see, you know, more developments around the community in understanding, you know, having that deaf awareness training and setting up more things like community events.
Someone leading the charge in those community events is Samantha Cranston, who hosts a monthly Auslan and Friends dinner.
For the deaf community to catch up and meet up with each other, but also to introduce some of the students who are learning Auslan and some of the community members to come in and introduce themselves, either to make new friends, to either network, or to start breaking down those barriers between the hearing and the deaf world.
You probably noticed Samantha sounds very similar to Callie Green. That's because Samantha is the only professional Auslan interpreter in the city of Rockhampton, where more than 81,000 people call home.
It is my first language, so I learnt Auslan before I learnt to speak. So both of my parents are deaf, so which makes me a coder, a child of deaf adults.
She says the city is desperate for more interpreters, not only for accessibility, but to give people a choice in who represents them.
I'm it. There's no other interpreter here. There's a few hours out there is on either side, but I try and put this community first as often as I possibly can.
Sadly, it's a similar situation right across regional and rural Australia. Brent Phillips is the Chief Impact Officer of DeafConnect. Again, he's using an interpreter.
There is a lack of certified Auslan interpreters and a national shortage of Auslan interpreters, even within the metro precincts. It is, however, much worse in rural and regional areas.
Which means people in the community simply don't have access to things others might take for granted.
So, say, for example, meetings with their managers at work, taking their child to swim classes and having those general interactions. So every day there are things that normal Australians are able to participate in that, unfortunately, there is that additional barrier for deaf people due to a lack of interpreters.
But there's hope. The Australian Government's Disability Royal Commission report recommended federal and state governments develop a workforce strategy to increase the number of skilled Auslan interpreters.
So we are very hopeful that the federal government will prioritise that particular recommendation whilst also investing in the educator workforce, the teaching workforce, again, not only in metro locations, but in rural and remote, as well as investing in the technology to connect in students who wish to become interpreters.
Brent Phillips from DeafConnect, ending that report by Jasmine Hines. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Rachel Mealy.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. For decades, we've turned to well-read textbooks to help us understand how our economy will behave. But right now, something strange is happening. And for some economists, it's a bit of a miracle. Today, business editor Ian Verinder on the current economic weirdness. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.